So these two come with the lack of understanding and knowledge of where sustenance comes from. And you say, oh Allah, you know, you're not going to give me, so I have to keep on saving and saving and saving because I don't know where it's going to come from tomorrow. The other one, cowardice, shows that you do not have trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You are scared. You do not say that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will only do what is best for you. You do not put your trust in the affairs, or rather you don't put your affairs in the hands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You're always scared that, oh, if I do that, I might lose it. Or even if you do lose it, there's always a place and this thing that it was for the best. Maybe there was something better waiting for me. These are some examples. Obviously, there are many other examples that we can mention. So these are the consequences, or some of the consequences, of having an ill and a low opinion of the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala never give us this type of attribute. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
This one lay, this one lay.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavitat Lee. The use of sanctions as blind instruments to pressure nations. That is one accusation that has been leveled against the UN, an international body that was created to resolve world crises, not to be a tool by mostly Western veto-wielding members to be used against other nations. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will examine the shortfalls of the UN Security Council, the reforms that many are asking for the Council to go through, particularly why it has been used as a tool for political gains.
The Security Council is one of the six primary organs of the United Nations, created after the Second World War. The Council has wide-ranging powers, including the approval of changes to UN charters, enacting international sanctions, and even authorizing military action. The UNSC is arguably the most powerful UN organ because it is the only one with the ability to pass binding resolutions. Hence, it would not be an exaggeration to say its decisions could have global impact. However, despite its immense importance, the Council is anything but inclusive. Although the UN General Assembly has more than 190 members, only 15 are in the Security Council. Of those, 10 gain their seats on a rotating basis, while only 5 countries, namely the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Russia, and China, are permanent members with veto powers. This puts enormous power in the hands of only a few governments, which have time and again shown they are not afraid of using it. In the past, the Council has imposed sanctions on countries like Libya, North Korea, and Yemen. Iran, also a victim of UNSC sanctions, has censured the Council's use of such restrictions under unsubstantiated pretexts. Tehran's UN ambassador on Tuesday described sanctions as blunt and blind instruments that raise fundamental ethical questions. He said the sanctions should be reserved as a last resort, but right now they are being used as a tool of collective punishment.
In the past, certain Security Council sanctions have served only to collectively punish an entire nation, without any actual positive impact on the maintenance of international peace and security.
Furthermore, the Iranian ambassador criticized the UNSC's makeup. He declared that the council must be reformed to ensure equitable rather than geographical representation. He also slammed the disproportionate presence and power of Western nations in the influential organ.
Currently, the West has a strong presence and influence in the council. Three of its members have veto power, while the main regions are fully represented in terms of both the number as well as privileges, including veto power. This means inequality among the regions.
The stated goal of the Security Council is to maintain international peace and security, but on numerous occasions it has in fact acted as an obstacle in the way of justice. For instance, the veto-wielding United States has blocked the passage of over 50 resolutions critical of Israel's policies since 1972. And U.S.-backed Israel, too, has defied dozens of resolutions on its crimes against Palestinians with impunity. The Security Council's far-reaching jurisdiction makes its importance hard to overstate. That significance is perhaps exactly what makes the Council's overhaul more needed in the current circumstances.
Well, I guess joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have Alfred de Zayas, who's a former U.N. Special Rapporteur on the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order. Also joining us is Macharia Munen, a UN expert on decolonization, who joins us on the phone from Nairobi.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, let me first start with you, Alfred Zayas, if I may. And I would like to ask whether you agree with this stance on the UN, that it is a truly representative, effective, transparent, accountable, and above all, rules-based body.
I could, huh? In my 14 reports to the Human Rights Council and the General Assembly, I frequently identified the obstacles exactly to being such an effective rules-based organization. My former boss, Secretary General Kofi Annan, was one of the first to recognize the problems and to propose very concrete reforms to the United Nations in general and in particular to the Security Council. In my 2013 report to the General Assembly, I also laid out a plan of action how to reform the system, how to reform the Security Council, and I reflect that, by the way, in my new publication, Building a Just World Order, which also includes 25 principles of international order. Of course, we can and must reform the United Nations. But obviously, those five powers that possess not only permanent membership but also the veto power are not likely to give up their privileges that easy. Article 108 of the UN Charter allows for amending the Charter. It has been used before. The size of the council, for instance, has been increased. Kofi Annan proposed that it be increased from 15 to 25, and obviously that means that major countries India and Brazil and Japan also have a claim to membership in the Security Council. Whether they would ever get the veto power is something else. Initially, I used to be very critical of the veto power. On the other hand, I remember a debate I had in the General Assembly, and the Russian ambassador at the time took me to task because I said, look, if we didn't have the veto power, NATO countries would go ahead and bombard the rest of the world and call it legal because it would be approved by the Security Council. And then he said, look, we made a mistake back in 2011 when supposedly humanitarian assistance was going to be given to Libya. And instead of humanitarian assistance, what NATO did was to bomb the hell out of it. That was Resolution 1973, which went through not with the approval of Russia and China, but with their abstention. So in the future, clearly, the Soviet Union, or rather Russia and China, have blocked supposedly humanitarian intervention resolutions tabled, for instance, against Syria. And that is understandable. So if you're going to do away with the veto power, make sure that that doesn't open the floodgates for indiscriminate attacks under Chapter 7. It is Chapter 6 of the UN Charter that should be used, which is the Charter on Pacific Settlement of Disputes.
All right, let's bring in Macharia Munin into this. Macharia Munin, our guest there talked about one example, and that was the Libya case, and also he talked about the veto power. In your assessments or in your recollection, what perhaps has led to calls for reforms for the UN? What examples can you give us or reasons that you think the UN needs to be reformed? And where did it go wrong that this call was made? Because it's been in the works for quite some time, the call for reform for the UNSC.
That different. When the UN Security Council was formed back in 1945, the logic of it was that the Security Council was there to protect the interests of the then big powers. That's why they gave themselves veto. That they were the one to determine what is safe for the world, and in case any of their interests were to be infringed by global democracy, then they gave themselves the power to reject global democracy. So the environment of the 1945 after World War II is now very different. We have more countries. We have more assertive interests coming into field. And we have seen over time that the big powers of the day at that time, which appeared to be in agreement, are no longer working together. They do not look after the interest of the world. Instead, they look after their perceived interest. And sometimes they make decisions that would otherwise not be acceptable just because they are big. The example given about the invasion of Libya through the UN Security Council's supposed resolution is an example of that. Of course, there have been issues of vetoes when it comes to what Israel does or does not do. And in the days of the Cold War, there appeared to have been competitions between the United States and the Soviet Union as to who can veto more than the other the UN resolutions. So now with the increasing talk of global democracy, and it is an increasing talk of global democracy, then the idea that one country can veto the world interest becomes obnoxious. We also have a few more countries that feel that they are strong enough to be in the big boys club. So you have Brazil, you have India, you have Japan, you have Germany, which are big economic powers, but they are not acceptable because they were supposedly not there in 1945, or they were on the wrong side of the big powers of the day. Today, some of them are seen to be good countries, mm-hmm. yet they are not acceptable into the Security Council as permanent members. The okay. challenge that comes is convincing the five permanent members that they should expand their numbers and dilute their own power is a very challenging thing.
Sure. Well, that's one of the things that Alfred Desaias, I'm curious as to how it can be solved in terms of the fair distribution of a say for countries that do not have representation, in a matter of speaking, or even continents. I mean, you're looking at the five countries that have the veto power. Is this the major, you think, problem that the UN has? Because when you have the Middle East, or we call West Asia, or Africa not having that representation, then what can be done? Adding countries to the list, is that a solution?
This
is for Alfred Desaias. Alfred Desaias, this question is for you. Go ahead.
Well, I fully agree with what my colleague, Professor Macharia Munene, just said. Beyond that, obviously, just a numerical increase of the Security Council will make it somewhat more equitable, somewhat more representative of the world. But what you want also is what Ambassador Majid Tanta Ramanchi said, to address the ethical issues that are involved. There, about a third of the population of the world is suffering under illegal unilateral coercive measures, which have been condemned by the General Assembly and have been condemned by the Human Rights Council repeatedly. What the international community has to do, and that is the responsibility of the General Assembly, is to elevate the issue to the highest judicial instance of the United Nations, being the International Court of Justice. And it is quite clear to me that sanctions kill. Not only do sanctions kill, but they kill hundreds of thousands of people. Because that is that, it should be declared not only illegal, because it is, of course, illegal, but a crime against humanity. And then that should be referred on to the International Criminal Court to prosecute those countries that have imposed sanctions on other countries which suffer, they're crippled, for instance, in the battle against COVID-19, and their economies are asphyxiated. So that has to be addressed, and these are ethical issues. These are issues of human rights, of the right to life, of the right to food, of the right to water, etc. So back to the reform proposals, yes, let's increase the membership from 15 to 25, but there are many other mechanisms that must be put in place.
Uh-huh.
There is, by the way, a working group of the General Assembly that is looking and has been looking for the last 15 years, looking at reform. But of course, that gets systematically blocked by those who are not interested in reform.
Sure.
But the possibility is there, Article 108 of the UN Charter, which provides for amendment.
Macharia Munene, let's look at a case in point here when it comes to sanctions. And that would be no better place to start with than the Islamic Republic of Iran. When you take a look at what has been leveled against Iran in terms of sanctions, the story obviously is very long. But my question to you is, do you think that using Iran as an example, that you have three of the five countries that have the veto power to have leveled sanctions against Iran for their own political gains? That is one of the critiques that has been leveled against the UN when it comes to Iran, specifically those three countries, in order to achieve whatever objectives they have by their use of sanctions, which Iran deems illegal.
The sanctions in many instances, are placed on technicalities, many of them illegal. We do have, I think, in the case of Iran at present, there are some, but were largely imposed by the last administration, the U.S. administration, which negated its own treaty on the and what had been agreed. And the interesting thing is that the new administration, U.S. administration, continues to stick to those sanctions and not very willing to review the whole thing. But sanctions are politically driven moves by powerful countries that use the United Nations as an instrument of their own foreign policy. So in this case, the three powers with the veto capacity are the United Nations, who are also negotiating involved in the Iran treaty on nuclear activities. It is a political tool, and this should be understood that way. As to whether or not there can be reforms, we can demand reforms. In fact, it is an attitude thing, and it is for the General Assembly collectively to come together and shame the ones who are standing on the way of reform, and to point out that the sanctions which are targeted for the wrong reasons are actually tantamount to criminality in the global thinking. But that mind frame of the big powers, that they have to protect themselves irrespective of what is what needs to be, it's unethical, but it's a moral issue, and they need to be ashamed in order to see sense that they should accommodate other people.
Okay, Alfred Isaias, I'm going to ask you whether you can guess what entity we're talking about here. And this question that I have for you is that since the inception of the council, this would be the UN HRC, okay? Since its inception in the year 2006, it has issued 142 condemnations against UN member states. Out of the 142, 95 was leveled against, and I'm wondering if you know who that would be.
Well, the United Nations Human Rights Council does have a focus on Israel, and it does have a permanent item on its agenda on Israel. So it's no surprise that there are so many resolutions adopted against Israel. On the other hand, you have to consider that since 1967, there is a Security Council resolution 242 that condemned the occupation of Palestine territories by Israel, and that in 2004, the International Court of Justice issued a very clear, long advisory opinion on the illegality of Israeli actions in Palestine territories, in particular the building of the wall, and that Israel has flouted countless resolutions of the General Assembly and of the Human Rights Council. So, hello. I mean, you cannot be part of the international community and continue flouting the violations, or rather the resolutions that have been adopted, telling you to correct the situation. That's why the General Assembly, surely the Security Council will not adopt resolutions against Israel, because they will be vetoed either by the United States, the United Kingdom, or France. On the other hand, the General Assembly can here take the lead and in particular elevate a number of legal issues under Article 96 of the UN Charter. The General Assembly can ask the International Court of Justice to rule on some of these issues. I'm saying not only Israel, also on the issue of collective punishment.
Sure. But my point here was when you have the incident that happened at the end of October, and let me make sure that I get this right, where you have the at the UNGA, you have the Israeli ambassador to the UN, Gilad Erdan, at the podium there, tear up that report. It just shows that Israel doesn't want to follow international laws, which it keeps breaking, and resolutions are leveled against it. That was the point that I was trying to get at. Unfortunately, we just are fresh out of time. I do have to end this spotlight, but thank you, Alfred Desaias, former UN Special Rapporteur on the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order. And the name of your book is A Just World Order, which is the book by Desaias. Also, Macharia Munen, thank you, UN expert on decolonization from Nairobi. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikove Tafwe, it's goodbye until next time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, dispraised the hypocrite person who was double-faced and double-tongued. He, peace be upon him, said, "Bad is the servant who is double-faced and double-tongued. He flatters his brother when he is present. He backbites him when he is absent. He envies his brother when he is given something. He betrays him when he is afflicted by tribulation." These qualities denote that such a person has an evil soul, has no morals, and that he has no faith in his Lord.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about these beautiful dialogues, these great golden conversations that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam had throughout his life. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, this divinely appointed imam, would be able to answer questions in such a simple manner, yet despite these answers being simple on the superficial level, we find that these answers were very profound, very complex, very beautiful, yet easy to understand. And so we find in one of these conversations that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam was asked, is there a thing better than gold? Now, of course, even in today's age, we will find that gold, or let's say wealth or diamonds, these things are considered the absolute most precious things that you can own. Now, because this is 1,400 years ago, the most precious thing that an individual could own was gold. And so in today's time, you could also say that the most precious thing is gold. I mean, really, how many people have gold or diamonds or, let's say, billions of dollars? So here Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is asked, what is more valuable than $1 billion? What is more valuable than gold? Imam al-Baqir answered, and I would really like everyone to pay attention to this. When asked, is there anything better than gold? Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam answers, yes, there is something better than gold. And that is the one who gives it. Allahu Akbar. An answer which I think nobody expected. The thing that is better than gold is the one who gives it away. In such a beautiful manner, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has explained so many things to us in this very simple statement, in this very simple and short conversation with one of his companions. What is really the worth of this materialistic world? Two, what is the great importance of giving charity? And three, why should we fall in love with this materialistic wealth when it is better to just give it away on the path of Allah and for the sake of Allah? Three very simple things, and I guarantee you that if you sit and you reflect over this statement, what is better than gold? The one who gives it, you will find more doors of knowledge and wisdom will open. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. The Imam's stressed on this for that time onwards, so all the way until the end of the minor occultation, when Khulaini puts his book together, he is relying on a volume of resources, books of various scholars. Does he just take that book and narrate whatever's in it? Absolutely not. But this is the book of Hariz ibn Abdullah al-Sajistani, the student of Zurara ibn A'yan. Doesn't matter, that's what the book says, but there's this copy, there's the other copy, this one comes from this person, that comes from that person. Very, the reason why the hadith book of Al-Kafi took 20 years to compile is not because the resources weren't there. It's because Khulaini is very careful. Where did this come from? Where did that come from? Now, if Khulaini did that, does that mean whatever he says? No, that doesn't mean if his judgment is that it's the saying of the Imam. Although this filters out a lot of stuff, it still doesn't mean it's necessary. There's still the process of ijtihad in looking at this. This is the teaching of Imam al-Baqir. Now, the process of ijtihad, identifying transmitters of hadith and so on and so forth, this is a difficult task. It's not something that we can just sit down and after maybe a couple days of discussion, a couple of hours each day, now like, okay, you can have the, for those who even know the Arabic language. That's not what we're suggesting. I'm giving you that background of hadith and also the knowledge that not all of our hadith are actually said by the imams, if we have it even in our books. It doesn't necessarily mean that.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
For the fourth time, the Israeli High Court has rejected an appeal made to release Kaid al-Fasfus, a Palestinian prisoner whom his health condition is seriously deteriorating due to his open-ended hunger strike that he started 125 days ago. Al-Fasfus is protesting his imprisonment under Israel's administrative detention without charge or trial. The Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, who made the appeal, says Al-Fasfus could be minutes away from sudden death, especially after doctors at the Berzelay Medical Center, where he's being hospitalized, said diagnosis showed he developed blood clots.
It's obvious that Israeli authorities want to adopt a new approach in dealing with the hunger strikes against administrative detention. They are exerting force at the utmost. Even if Al-Fasfus or other hunger striking prisoners die, they don't care. Maybe they think this way they will be unfolding this file. We are continuing our efforts and we really hope Al-Fasfus won't die because the repercussions will be out of control inside the jails and outside it.
In addition to Qaid Al-Fasfus, four other prisoners have been refusing to eat, also to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. They are all demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. Weekly protests continue to take place in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners. Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah.
Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoners follow the same path in the future.
The Israeli occupation does not know the meaning of humanity. Literally, those prisoners are dying. They must immediately be released. Their detention is illegal in the first place.
Over the years, Israel has placed thousands of Palestinians in administrative detention for prolonged periods of time without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports, which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds over 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, with some 500 of them under the illegal administrative detention.
Prisoners' advocacy groups say the only request of Qaid Al-Fasfus and other Palestinian hunger-striking prisoners is their freedom and an end to their arbitrary administrative detention. After 125 days of an open-ended hunger strike against Israel's illegal policy, Al-Fasfus' family says he would be victorious either through his long-awaited release or martyrdom. Muna Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Political factions in the Gaza Strip, along with the Joint Committee for Refugees, gathered in front of the UNRWA office in the Gaza Strip to reject the framework agreement signed between the United States and the agency regarding the restoration of U.S. funding for the UNRWA. The demonstration comes in conjunction with the International Conference for UNRWA, where several donor countries are scheduled to convene in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden to discuss resuming the financial support to the UN agency and the Palestinian Authority.
We are holding this press conference based on our Palestinian people's demands all over the world. At the same time, the International Conference for UNRWA is being held in Brussels. UNRWA has been suffering from a critical impasse, and the victims of the shortage of aid are the poor Palestinian refugees. We are all united in expressing that we won't give up our right of return, and we have been calling for this right for 73 years. The international community is now in front of the real test whether to be committed to its conventions or not.
The framework for cooperation between the UNRWA and the U.S. for 2021-2022 calls for restoring U.S. funding to the UN agency after it was cut off for several years under former U.S. President Donald Trump. It includes that the U.S. will not make any contributions to UNRWA except on the condition that UNRWA ensures that no part of the U.S. contribution is used to assist any refugee receiving military training as a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organizations.
We are calling the donor countries to support the issue of Palestinian refugees that was founded basically by U.S. UNRWA has been the only witness for all the violations of Palestinians' rights, and the international community should maintain a long-term and sustainable fund to support Palestinian refugees until they gain their freedom. This is a systematic conspiracy to demolish the issue of Palestinian refugees.
UNRWA provides services, especially in health and education, for more than 5.5 million Palestinian refugees. Palestinians say that UNRWA must remain committed to its duties until their right of return is guaranteed. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
The Joint Conference of Syrian and Russian Committees formed last year on Syrian refugees' return was held in Damascus. Syria's Minister of Local Administration said amnesty decrees and investment laws issued by Syria proves the government's genuine desire for refugees to come back. Officials said hundreds of thousands of refugees returned in the past years.
We formed two committees from Russia and Syria for implementing steps for refugees' return. Over 2 million displaced Syrians returned so far. Nearly 1 million of them came from foreign countries. There are 13 border crossings fully ready to receive refugees. Return of displaced resulted in dismantling 26 temporary shelters this year.
Syrian Foreign Ministry officials asserted that the government continues to repair the infrastructure and restore basic services to areas liberated by the Syrian government from terror, noting to some obstacles in the face of refugees, such as U.S. and Turkish occupation of Syrian soil, support to terrorist groups, and looting natural resources.
The Syrian government continues to take all measures for Syrians' return. Our efforts are faced by some conspiring countries' attempts to take advantage of the refugees' issue politically and exercise systematic misleading campaign that the situation is unstable, as well as lies that refugees are in danger if they return.
Russian President's special envoy told Press TV that the West started to realize they should shift their policy towards Syrians' repatriation.
Western countries were doing everything possible, and there was huge information and campaign against what has been done here, you know, and they were trying just to convince everybody that the conditions are not ready for the Syrian refugees to return. It comes to this, to the understanding of the Western countries, that they have to start to be more active themselves now. I think that's a good start. It takes, they need time, of course, because they cannot just change completely their policy.
11 agreements and one contract have been prepared to be signed between Syria and Russia in the fields of education, medicine, culture, science, and industry. The gradual restoration of relations between Syria and the Arab world, as well as the enhancement of economic ties with the country's neighbors, constitute a spark of hope for all Syrian refugees that their homeland started its journey of recovery from war, a fact that represents a solid encouragement for their return. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Wailing and crying, seeking the dead body of their beloved son, the relatives of Mudassir Gul, a doctor by profession, was killed on Monday, along with other civilian and two fighters, during a gun battle in Srinagar.
Authorities say he was involved with fighter and killed in crossfire. We know he was an innocent. Now that he is dead, at least return his dead body. The police have denied us his last rites.
The military operation took place on Monday evening in Srinagar, the main city of Muslim-majority Kashmir. According to police reports, the fighters had holed up in a building in the Hyderabad area and were eliminated by the government forces. The Inspector General of Kashmir Police, while talking to the media, said,
"The building owner was killed in a crossfire, while the fourth person was an overground worker, OGW, who was provided his rented space to Hyder, foreign fighter, for using the same as militant hideout."
The building owner's daughter, however, accuses the government forces of using his father as a human shield.
"Security forces took my father inside the building, not once but thrice. On the third turn, he did not return, and they say he was killed in crossfire. Now that they have killed my innocent father, they must return his dead body."
The police chief said, fearing law and order problems, the dead bodies were not handed over to the families for last rites.
It is not sure whether a militant bullet or the bullets fired by forces hit him. It would be clear after investigations whose bullet hit him.
Following the COVID-19 pandemic protocol, the authorities in Indian-controlled Kashmir have denied the last rites to the families of fighters killed during the military operations in Kashmir since 2020. Dozens of fighters have been buried at far-off locations, guarded and inaccessible to families. More recently, Kashmir's tallest pro-freedom leader, Sayyid Ali Gilani's family, was also denied his last rites, something for which New Delhi was highly criticized.
Although having a decent burial is a fundamental right, here in Kashmir, it is seen as a breeding ground for anti-India sentiments and irregularities. Human rights defenders say denying families a proper funeral for their loved ones is a gross violation of human rights and a reason for unending pain for their kin. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Iran's envoy for Afghanistan, Hassan Kazemi Qumi, has arrived in Kabul for talks on mutual and regional issues. This is the first time that a high-ranking Iranian delegation is visiting Afghanistan since the takeover of the country by the Taliban in August. In an address to reporters upon his arrival in Kabul airport, the Iranian envoy said he would meet senior Taliban officials, adding that security and economic issues would top the agenda. He stressed that two neighboring countries need to expand their ties in all areas.
Afghanistan has been destroyed by invaders over the past decades. Now it's time to rebuild the country. We will help our Afghan brothers rebuild their country. A secure Afghanistan can contribute to regional stability. Afghanistan and Iran should have safe borders and expand their economic ties amid U.S. sanctions. We also need to cooperate in the fight against terrorism, as our enemies are conducting proxy wars after their repeated defeats in the region.
On the other hand, the Taliban have voiced their interest in the expansion of ties with Iran. They vow to continue their talks with the aim of increasing mutual cooperation.
Iran's move to send its special envoy means that the country is seeking to establish normal relations with us and increase the level of cooperation between the two sides. We have many things in common, particularly when it comes to border security and economic exchanges, so we have to continue our talks.
Tehran has stressed the necessity to establish an inclusive government in Afghanistan, representing all sections of Afghan society. Iran has repeatedly condemned any form of terrorism in Afghanistan and expressed its deep concerns over the fate of Afghan civilians, particularly following the recent terrorist attacks which left hundreds of Shia Afghans dead or wounded. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Israel has always touted its intelligence agency as invulnerable, but a spate of recent hacking attacks against the regime has undermined the narrative. A hacking group, which calls itself Moses' Staff, has released a video saying it has successfully carried out a massive cyber attack on Israel and broken into the servers of its major companies. The group says it is now in possession of comprehensive data, which include information on the location and properties of the regime's sensitive and vital systems across the occupied Palestinian territories. The data also includes airborne mapping surveys with 5-centimeter accuracy and three-dimensional images of Israeli military sites. Moses' Staff is the third group of its kind that has exclusively hacked Israeli organizations and released confidential information of high-ranking military officials in cyberspace in recent months. Such cyber attacks have exposed the weakness of Israel's spying apparatus. But such incidents are just the tip of the iceberg. In September, six Palestinian inmates escaped from one of Israel's highest security jails, which was described by Palestinian resistance groups as a major intelligence failure. Following Israel's 11-day war on Gaza in May, the regime's intelligence and spying fiasco also made headlines. This was due to severe blows the regime received after Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel. At that time, Palestinian media said the Israeli spying services could not predict Hamas and Islamic Jihad movement's tactics to beat the regime's most wanted Iron Dome system. Israeli media also called for a purge of the regime's military leaders for their role in the failed war on Gaza. Such failures come amid internal divisions inside Mossad. Recently, three senior Mossad officials stepped down over what was cited as organizational changes by the agency's new chief, David Barnea. However, Israeli media have described their resignations as an earthquake. Such a description has highlighted major setbacks Mossad has suffered not only in field operations but also in cyberspace. The blows that Israel has received have further shattered the image of its invulnerability.
A weekend terror incident in Liverpool, UK. One man killed, one injured, and four aged between 20 and 29 arrested under the controversial counter-terrorism law. The mood among some, one of shock and disbelief.
Honestly, shock. You know, I couldn't believe it. I've never been around anything like this in my life. I moved up here just for uni, so to have something happen like this, you know, right next to my accommodation is very scary.
Police say the passenger, 32-year-old Imad Al-Suwaylmin, carried a homemade explosive device into the taxi. The driver, David Perry, who locked the suspect in the car to prevent a worse situation, escaped with minor injuries. The timing has had everyone thinking, just 2 minutes before Remembrance Sunday, when the entire country remembers Britons killed in wars. In Monday, the government raised the terror threat level from substantial to severe, warning residents to be vigilant.
The police have now confirmed that this is being treated as a terrorist attack, and while the investigation continues at pace, you will understand that I can't comment on the details of the case or its motivation, but it is a stark reminder of the need for us all to remain utterly vigilant.
There are still three police cordons in the city, one here at the Women's Hospital, the site of the explosion, and the two major streets elsewhere. Police are still investigating to establish the circumstances of what happened. Police are still searching two addresses for more clues into the motivation behind the incident. Saeed Fariza, Liverpool.
The violence in Myanmar was not enough for us, says the desperate woman upon our arrival. She says we are calling God in every possible way, but looks like our prayers are not being heard. She has many complaints, yet she can talk about the basic ones.
There is a huge list of problems that we are facing, but the major issue is every one of us has not received free COVID vaccination, and many had to spend their own money to get those. Another major hurdle is the lack of toilets for us and shortage of water supply. With regards to food, God sends many good people to feed us almost every day.
After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of India. But in India, they are sometimes called termites, sometimes illegal immigrants. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities. But these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis.
Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family, sounds like an encouraging phrase. But looking at the living conditions of these refugees leads one to ask question whether the world has abandoned its responsibility towards them.
Rohingya refugees are struggling to survive in the world's largest democracy with enormous quantities of effort. Over the last few years, the community is in utter distress, sometimes detention in midnight raids, sometimes their camps being mysteriously burnt down. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, this particular community continues to be unseen victims of violence.
Since our camp was razed down by fire, we have relocated to this place. And it's a very difficult situation in terms of living in crumbling space. We are having shortage of water supplies. A tanker arrives and it finishes within an hour. Another major issue is snakes on this land and the lack of toilets for women.
Official estimates suggest more than 40,000 Rohingya Muslims have sought refuge in India after a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, a vicious campaign against their expulsion is haunting the community.
An
an interview released by Al-Qaeda's media, the leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Khaled Batarfi, admitted that the terrorists have been fighting forces of Yemen's Ansarullah movement on 11 fronts. Batarfi said the role in fighting the Houthi fighters is clear and no one can deny it. This raises a fresh speculation about the cooperation between the Saudi-led forces and the Al-Qaeda terrorists, previously reported by media, including the 2016 battle for Taiz.
Al-Qaeda leaders' confession of their participation in the battles against the Yemeni army confirms our earlier remarks that there is a strategy taken by the Saudis.